You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Anthony Richter, Associate Director of OSI. Pleased to welcome you to another one of our open forum presentations. We're very fortunate today to have with us Anthony Shadid. Those of you who are regular daily readers, like I am, of the Washington Post, and before that of the Boston Globe, are very well familiar with Anthony Shadid's writings. The work was recognized in 2004 by a Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his coverage of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which he covered from Baghdad, not embedded. What I've enjoyed in reading his work over the years, in particular, has been the honesty and the insights that he has provided. There's a part in the book that he'll be discussing today, where he and a fellow columnist, correspondent from the Washington Post, Thomas Ricks, are walking down a street with a patrol of U.S. soldiers soon after the fall of Baghdad. And Ricks, playing, I guess, to his strong suit, is walking with the troops, right. And they're all very happy with how well received they are, and they tell Ricks, which I think is also in Fiasco, his book, he said how much the Iraqis love us. Walking 30 paces behind is Anthony Shadid, speaking Arabic with the local population, and getting a very different story. And to write that today, of course, is a no-brainer. To write that in April, May of 2003 not only takes physical courage that was implicit in reporting the story from Baghdad, but also the honesty that has very often in the past several years been abrogated, either explicitly or by co-optation during the process of covering this war. And that's one of the reasons why we're particularly happy to have him here today to speak honestly with us, to tell us his thoughts. He, for those of you who aren't absolutely clear on it, he is the Middle East correspondent for the Washington Post. And before we proceed to the actual event, I have to read this following disclaimer to advise you, and if anybody wants to free me from doing this, I'm happy not to do it, but I have to advise you that OSI may be recording this event, and your presence and participation for possible may be recording this event and your presence and participation for possible subsequent distribution. Your continued presence following this notice constitutes your legal permission to OSI to do so, as stated on the placard posted at this podium and or in the on the walls of this room. Okay, quite a mouthful. He has to sign a release. So without further ado, I'm going to give the floor to Anthony Shadid, who'll speak to us for 20-25 minutes, and then we'll have a discussion with him. So great. Welcome. Thank you.
And it's a real pleasure to join you all today. It's these are the kind of events I enjoy the most. When we get to talk a little bit about Iraq, and then also opening up to questions and answers about both Iraq and the region as well. It's a remarkable time, I think, in the region. And sometimes I wonder, when I'm working there as a reporter, if we understand the scale of what we are witnessing in some ways. I think there is a transformation underway. And I think in some ways that transformation is charted by the conflict in Iraq and the repercussions of that war. It's going to be a legacy that I don't know at this point what that legacy is going to be. And but you do kind of feel the scale and that we're going to be covering the legacy of this war for perhaps a generation or so. Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that conflict in Iraq. And I always the Night Draws Near kind of grew out of reporting that I tried to start well, that it did during the invasion and during the aftermath. And I kind of fell into this type of reporting. I think there was a bias, a certain inclination against basically talking to people in Iraq before the fall of Saddam. There was a sense that it was a dictatorship, that people themselves weren't going to be able to speak forthrightly, that it wasn't really worth, you know, doing these interviews because we couldn't hear all that much. And I remember I was struck really early on, even back in 2002, that I was hearing things that I didn't expect, that sentiments were a lot more complicated, a lot more ambiguities, a lot more gray. And I think that was even more pronounced during the invasion, when you felt that something had broken, and people were speaking in ways that I hadn't heard before. You know, and that kind of reporting evolved over time, and it did become a way to get around this problem I think a lot of reporters face, and that's, how do you cover war? How do you get beyond what often becomes repetitive in terms of the adjectives, in terms of the coverage, in terms of the approach to it? You know, war itself isn't all that interesting, I have to say. And what I've tried to do in both Night Draws Near and some of the reporting, you know, be it in Israel and Palestine, southern Lebanon this summer, or in Iraq, is to treat war as a backdrop and try to understand the more human story that plays out against that backdrop. Part of that approach has meant that the reporting itself has to go very small in a way. In some ways, has to be very intimate. And one of those stories that did become very small is one I was going to share with you. It's a story that's probably stuck with me more than any other story that I wrote. Be it with the Boston Globe, the AP, or then the Washington Post after the war began. In a lot of ways, says something about the country and its fate, and it's also a haunting one in a way. It happened back in, I guess, a couple of years ago now, really 3 years ago, back in May of 2003, and it's remarkable when we think back to that time in Iraq that we could do the reporting that we did. Basically, something had happened in a town called Dhul-Ayya, this beautiful, almost oasis-like town on the banks of the Tigris, about 90 minutes north of Baghdad, and we just jumped in a car and went. We'd gone to Dhul-Ayya because there had been a U.S. military operation there. And, you know, at that point, back in May of 2003, we really didn't have a sense that there was an insurgency. There had been sporadic attacks at that point, but, you know, to call it an insurgency would have been very controversial. And so this military operation, given its scale, it was 4,000 U.S. troops, attracted some attention. It was called Operation Peninsula Strike. And in some ways, Operation Peninsula Strike set the standard for how these military operations were going to play out in the months and years that followed, in the Sunni Triangle, basically the regions north and west of Baghdad. They were very aggressive. They led to detention of scores of suspects, and they often relied on informers. And this is what happened in Operation Peninsula Strike, is that they relied on an informer, a young man named Sabah. Now, Sabah had volunteered to help the Americans when they entered this village of Dhul-Ayya. Again, this is May of 2003, very early into the occupation. They dressed him in desert camouflage to conceal his identity. They put a burlap bag over his head. And then he walked through these detainees who had been handcuffed and were, you know, sitting under the sun in basically the town square. And he identified the people who he thought were insurgents. It turned out that it didn't take long before the villagers realized who Sabah was. They saw that his pinky was cut off above his joint. They noticed that he was wearing yellow sandals that he walked around in the village with. And they noticed his gait. And I think we were often struck in these villages how people, their antennas are always quivering. People can see a stranger, they can see somebody that's from their village very easily. And it didn't take long before they realized that this was in fact Sabah. Three people were killed during this operation. One of them was a 15-year-old boy whose body was found near the Tigris. And in the tribal traditions that had kind of grown up during the vacuum of authority that followed this collapse of Saddam's government, basically justice was being handled by tribal traditions. And relatives of one of the three people killed in that village went to Sabah's father, and they told him very bluntly that he had to kill his son in revenge for what had happened. Either he kill his son or they're going to kill Sabah's father and the rest of his family. Sabah's father appealed. He said, you know, nobody saw Sabah's face. They said no. He said, I have to talk to the Americans before I do something like this. They rejected that appeal. They said, simply put, you have to kill your son. A few weeks passed, and it was a couple of hours before the dawn call to prayer. The village was still shrouded in silence, and Sabah's father and Sabah's brother entered his room. They were both carrying AK-47s. And they led Sabah outside behind the house into an area where there were orchards of fig and almond trees, vineyards and groves of oranges and tangerines. Sabah's father's hands were trembling, and he raised his rifle and he aimed at his oldest son. One shot tore through Sabah's leg and another his chest. And the accounts I heard after that differed. Some said that Sabah's father collapsed into the ground, and that his brother then raised his rifle and fired another shot, at least one of those that hit Sabah in the head. Sabah was a tall, husky 28-year-old, soon died. And I sat with, I had gone to Thuluia, and I sat with Sabah's father in a simple home of cement and cinder blocks. He was nervously thumbing black prayer beads. The fans overhead were churning this oven-like air, and we drank tea. And silently, I replayed this question I had formulated in my head: had he killed his son? Of course, I already knew the answer at that point in the reporting. But when the opportunity arrived, I couldn't ask. Even as a journalist, I think in a profession that sometimes celebrates provocation, whose standards require confirmation, there still had to be a certain decency. At that point, I didn't want to hear him say yes, and I didn't want to humiliate him any further. And in the end, I didn't have to. His words were deepened by age and grief. He spoke softly. It was almost a whisper. And he dragged on a cigarette. I remember his eyes were glimmering. There was a faint trace of tears as he spoke. And he said, "I have the heart of a father, and he's my son. Even the prophet Abraham didn't have to kill his son." I remember he stopped for a moment and steadied his voice. "There was no other choice." I've often talked about this story when I've talked about reporting in Iraq or in writing Night Draws Near, and I think the reaction has often been that it illustrates in some way the brutality of Iraq today. A friend of mine pointed this out to me, and I have to be honest, I shuddered at the thought that that's what this illustrated. Is that what it really showed? Or was it something deeper, something less perceptible? Sabah's death to me was less a story of brutality and more a tale of the repercussions of a country turned upside down, a landscape that could give rise to such a crime. And I think in that reading, it's a metaphor for what I've come to call the devastation of unintended consequences. To me, I think that's the most powerful lesson of our experience in Iraq. In one narrative, the United States came as a liberator, almost immediately became an occupier. But most important, I think it served as a catalyst for consequences that neither I nor most other journalists, I think, foresaw when we were in Iraq before the invasion. And whenever I come across this notion, this idea of unintended consequences, I think back to a man who became a good friend of mine, a man named Wamid Nadhma. I met him back in 2002. A colleague of mine had told me he was the only person worth talking to when Saddam was still in power. And there was a reason he was worth talking to. He was actually very forthright and very blunt. There's a reason he was forthright and blunt. Wamid had, back in 1959, been in Cairo, Egypt, in exile. He had gone there after being arrested and tortured, and he promised he would never be arrested and tortured again. He was still a member of the Ba'ath Party back in the late 1950s. He later left the party a decade later. And when he was there in the late 50s, he had received a call from Baghdad telling him that he should take care of seven men who were headed his way. These seven men had been involved in an assassination attempt on Iraq's president at the time. The attempt failed. They fled to Damascus, and then they came to Cairo. And Wamid had gone there to welcome them at the airport and then bring them back to his apartment. It turned out one of those seven men was a young Saddam Hussein. Wamid took care of him, helped him find a place. A year later, he heard that Saddam was getting his tonsils taken out, and Wamid decided, as a fellow Iraqi, he should go pay a visit. It turned out he was the only person that decided to visit Saddam back then. And as we sat in Baghdad before the invasion, Wamid was recounting the story, and almost as a way of telling me why he thought he could talk a little bit more honestly than others. I remember he said, "I usually don't like waking up early in the morning, but I thought, he's by himself. So I went to the hospital. Perhaps this is one of the reasons why Saddam did not cut off my head. I think somehow he had good memories of me." I remember Wamid at that time, we were basically waiting for the invasion, like I mentioned. It was still weeks away. Like a lot of people in Baghdad, I think he was confused by all this cacophony that was going on around him. And here were his words again. "I won't hide my feelings. The American invasion has nothing to do with democracy and human rights. It's basically an angry response to the events of September 11th, an angry response to the survival of Saddam Hussein, and it has something to do with oil in the area." I remember he talked about the 1990 invasion of Kuwait and said, and I was always surprised by how he said this, that the U.S.-led attack in that instance might have been justified. But how could you justify the sanctions that followed, the toll they took on Iraqi society? How could you justify another war at this point? It will bring more destruction, more civil war, and a nationalist war against American intervention in the internal affairs of Iraqis, he told me. Even if the Americans are capable of overthrowing the regime, they will face more and more resistance from factions and groups who are not necessarily pro-regime or armed by the regime. This is not politics, he said, and I remember this phrase well. This is a circus. I think these conversations I had with Wamid and others, this kind of ambiguity I heard even before the invasion, always struck me, because in a way I think it was a hint of what was ahead. It was a certain kind of splash of color across a monochromatic landscape, a signal of this complexity that I think we'd all encounter. You know, looking back, I think, especially back to that time before the invasion, I think in some ways we were blinded by the repression. We saw this repression that was overwhelming and suffocating, and it led us to see Iraq in very two-dimensional terms. I think we envisioned a country that was suffering under repression and victimization, and once the dictator is removed by force if need be, it would become a blank slate, a tabula rasa, if you will, in which we would build a new and a different state. And I think I spent my entire time in Iraq, 2 or 3 years, in a slow process of realization of understanding how wrong that was. When I look back to my years as a reporter, I realize I essentially covered the unintended consequences of that invasion. The gray that Wamid pointed out in that conversation back in 2002, his prediction in the grimmest terms of a circus, and also the tumult that emerged so quickly and that led in part to Sabah's death at the hands of his father and Dulorea a few months after Saddam's fall. I got back from Iraq a couple of weeks ago. On one of those days of reporting in Baghdad, I found myself in Ferdows Square, and I think some people may remember what that was. It's a once picturesque traffic circle. It had a statue back in 2002, where a statue of Saddam in suit and tie, his hand outstretched, pointing down Saadun Street. And around him were a series of columns of descending heights, each of them with the initials S and H inscribed on the top of them. On April 9th, dozens of people came around. April 9th of 2003, dozens of people had surrounded that statue. It was the last days of the war, and they had one idea in mind. They were going to bring the statue down. And I remember that day well. It was a very emotional day in a lot of ways. I remember feeling one way as a journalist, thankful that I wasn't going to die at that point. I felt another way as an Arab American, watching Baghdad, a city that I think is so storied in so many ways in the history of the Arab world, being conquered in the name of its liberation. And I also remember being struck by what this meant as an American. And to be honest, I was in awe of the power of my country at that point. What other nation driven by ideology could conquer another country in a matter of weeks? I remember thinking that the United States at that point had inherited Iraq. It was now going to decide its fate. And to a remarkable degree, it understood so little about what that country was. And deep down, I think I worried that it would never really try to understand it either. At best, we were going to force it into a construct or preconception of what a country should be. At worst, we wouldn't care, giving into overly emotional impressions that were distorted by differences in language, traditions, culture, and I think all too often, I think a lot of us would agree here, conceit and a certain arrogance. I went back to Ferdows Square a year later. At that time, I was trying to do some kind of anniversary piece to try to make sense of what it might represent on that day. And this was in April 2004. It was a very tumultuous time in Baghdad. Out west in Fallujah, Sunni insurgents were fighting the Marines. In Baghdad in southern Iraq, Shiite Muslim militiamen loyal to a young cleric named Muqtada Sadr were fighting another inconclusive battle. I remember that square that day, Ferdows Square, the same place where the statue had come down, was deserted. Was guarded by U.S. tanks whose barrels read Beastly Boy and Bloodlust. Soldiers were edgy. They had orders to shoot anyone with a weapon. And I remember on the speaker from one Humvee where a speaker had been set up, there was a song. There were songs blaring. One of them, I remember, was Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash. And I thought of the square, you know, a year earlier had represented the end of a dictatorship, the fall of Saddam. On that day, it spoke in very visceral terms, very powerful terms, to the notion of occupation. I went back to Ferdows Square a couple of weeks ago, and I was trying to figure out how I would describe the city today. I've always thought, and I've said this often, that the more time I spent in Iraq, the less I understood it. And I don't mean that in a flip way. I actually mean that sincerely. Each month I spent there, I realized how much more complicated it was, and how less I understood it. And I think the sentiment felt even stronger a couple of weeks ago when I went back there after 11 months of having not been there. A few days earlier, I talked to a psychiatrist, a man named Harith Abdelhamid, and I asked him that same question. How would you describe Baghdad today? How would you make sense of it? And here's what he said. He said, it's a civil war at this point. When you see hundreds of people killed every day, corpses of people tortured in the streets every day, what else does it mean? Call it what you will, but it's a civil war. And I remember thinking as he said this, I thought, you know, maybe that's the case, perhaps. But I also thought I was witnessing something more as I worked in Baghdad in October. I thought what I was witnessing basically was the final frenzied maturity of these once inchoate forces that had been unleashed more than 3 years ago by the invasion. In a way, what I was seeing was the visceral realization of these unintended consequences that Wamid had talked about back in 2002. There was a civil war-style sectarian killing going on, echoes of what we saw in Lebanon a generation ago in the 1970s and 1980s. Alongside it were gangland-style turf battles over money, power, and survival. There were a raft of political parties, each with their own militias, and I think militias is often a polite way of saying basically a bunch of young guys with guns. A raging insurgency, the collapse of authority, social services that still don't really exist 3 years after the fall. And I think in some ways, most dangerously, no way forward for an Iraqi government that is still ordered to act by the Americans, who themselves are still seen, and I stress the word seen, who are still perceived as the final arbiter, and as a result still deprive that government of its legitimacy. I remember thinking that civil war was perhaps too easy a term, too tidy a way to describe what was going on in the city. I remember looking out at the square. On one side were these rows of concrete barricades and barbed wire. They've almost faded organically into the landscape around them. In one direction was a billboard that read, "Terrorism has no religion." Across the street there was a poster portraying Iraqi police. They were pleading. It almost felt desperate in a way. We are the heroes fighting for the sake of Baghdad. And in the middle of the square, on that same stone perch where Saddam's statue once stood, there were scraps of posters. Many of them had been torn down at that point. And there were words still visible. Your voice, the nation, patriotism, dialogue, building the future. The words in Arabic were isolated. They were without context, and they felt like pieces of a puzzle. It strikes me, and I think I realized that when I was there last month, is that the United States has been in Iraq almost as long as we fought World War II after Pearl Harbor. And I think these consequences that I'm talking about are still playing themselves out. And I have to say I'm pessimistic about the future. I'm worried about the Middle East. I live in Beirut now, from where I cover the region, and I look out at a region that's becoming increasingly riven by the same sectarian forces that were unleashed in Iraq. I think ideology in many ways in the Middle East has died, be it Arab nationalism, various leftist ideologies, and so on. And what are the successes or failures of those ideologies? They spoke to a universality that I think transcended these parochial identities of the past. That's no longer the case. It's not the case in Iraq. It's not the case of much of the Levant, of the Middle East. That might include Lebanon or Syria, Jordan, Palestine, and so on. In the place of ideology is a more primordial notion of self, as Sunni Muslims, as Shiite Muslims, as Kurds, as Christians, and so on. And I think identity has become the first and foremost the axis around which politics are organized today. In the end, you're left with tribes that are bereft of citizenship. Each tribe comes away with its own existential sense of itself, its very survival threatened by that uniqueness. I think from that same perch in Beirut, I look out at a region, I look out at the impact of the war on American standing, which is no question, or without question, the lowest point in recent memory. There's an anger that's deep, that's visceral, and that's withering in the region today. And I often wonder about what its implications are. In some ways, the Middle East that I started covering in 1995 with the Associated Press is unrecognizable to me. What are the implications? And I don't know. You know, I think back to these seminal moments in modern Middle East history, to the 1967 Arab-Israeli War and the way that signaled the ascent of a certain notion of political Islam, the way the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon served as the genesis of Hezbollah. I think back to the 1991 Gulf War and how that charted in some ways the ascent of Osama bin Laden. And I do wonder what the legacy of this war is going to be. I don't think we've seen it yet. I think we see the repercussions, the signals, the suggestions of it in places like Tripoli, for instance, and northern Lebanon. But I don't think we've seen the full ramifications of what this war is going to unleash. You know, and finally, I think about the consequences for Iraq itself. I think back to three of the people that I met there back in the invasion as a way of speaking to those repercussions. And I think these are the voices that are so often lost amid the chaos and the anarchy and the carnage that visits Baghdad and basically would have become killing fields. They're the debris that are left in the wake of these unintended consequences. One of these people is a woman named Karima Salman, and I met her during the invasion. I was doing a story on an Iraqi mother who was sending her son off to fight. She was a mother of eight. She was selling basically chewing gum on a sidewalk to support her family back then. And I was always struck because I think it's very rare as a man to be able to hear women's voices in the Middle East. And so I wanted to stay with that family and get to know that family better. And I did in the years that followed. I found her remarkable. I found her daughter remarkable as well, who kept a diary through the invasion, and which I wrote a lot about at Night Draws Near. On June 23rd of last year, three car bombs had gone off outside of Karima's house. They wrecked the mosque across the street, and they sprayed shrapnel through the window. Some of that shrapnel cut the forearm of her daughter, Hiba. It was quite a bit of nerve damage. 2 months ago, another car bomb went off. More shrapnel, more glass flew through a window, and it cut the head of Hiba's twin sister, Dua. She needed four stitches to close that wound. Karima, in those months that I hadn't seen the family, in 11 months between my last visit, had lost her job at the hotel where she earned about $30 a month. One of her sons, kind of a ne'er-do-well that I met during the invasion, at the time he was with the Ba'ath Party militia fighting for Saddam Hussein. Today he belongs to the Mahdi army, the militia that works for Muqtada Sadr and is blamed for much of the sectarian carnage going on in Baghdad today. His brother-in-law, a guy named Ali, had been a police officer in the U.S. trained and equipped police force. He got death threats last year, quit. Now he also belongs to that same militia, the same Mahdi army. And I remember as I sat with him last week or a couple weeks ago, I had just met her grandson, a two-month-old boy named Fahad, and I kept staring at his face, and there was something about his face that I couldn't quite place. I was trying to figure out what it was, and I realized that today the overwhelming sentiment, the overwhelming emotion that I think dominates Baghdad is fear. And you didn't see fear in that little boy's eyes. And I think Karima was struck. I guess she noticed that I was staring at the boy for so long, and at one point she finally turned to me and she said, "Is it not a pity to bring a baby into a world like this? It's a shame." There's another friend that I saw, a guy named Farouk Saadeddin, and I was always struck by Farouk. He's very, very urbane, former diplomat, liked to talk very much, and I always enjoyed my conversations with him. When I saw him last year, we were sitting in his neighborhood of Jihad. Jihad's become so dangerous at this point, you basically can't enter it as a stranger. Back then, as we sat in his house, he was upset. He was talking about how his oldest son had left the country, and he was worried what was going to happen to Iraq if its best and brightest, if its most capable fled. Here's what he said: "You can't just cut out and run away. This is our country, and sooner or later our children will come back. The resilience of the people, that's what 11,000 years of history means. Someone who has 11,000 years, 100 years to lose here or there, isn't all that much." On April 17th, Farouk and his wife fled themselves from the country. Their son had rented them an apartment in Jordan, and they went to Amman. A month later, a car bomb went off outside his home, destroying basically the room where we had sat the year earlier, drinking coffee and talking about Omar's departure. I had tracked him down in Jordan, and when I went to visit with him, he was basically just stunned at the arbitrariness of fate, how he had escaped certain death. And I remember his words: "We're all stranded, here and there, Iraqis." And finally, there was Wameed, the same professor that I'd come to know in 2002, and that I found myself relying on a lot in the years that followed about what was happening in his country, in his city. And when I saw him in his neighborhood of Adamiya in October, he told me that he basically had settled into withdrawal. He still visited the university once a week, but Baghdad was simply too dangerous to venture outside. I remember leaving his house at around 7 o'clock, just an hour after dusk, and the streets felt like they might feel a couple hours before dawn. They were dark, there was no traffic, and they were very menacing. As we sat and talked, helicopters rumbled overhead and gunfire burst almost continuously. And at one point in the conversation, he turned to me and he said, "You feel like the country is exploding." we talked for a while, and I asked him what would happen if, or asked him what would it become worse if the American military withdrew. And I remember he looked at me for a moment. He wasn't sure what to say. It was almost as if he was confused. And then he finally said, what could be worse? I saw him again a week later. And that question had lingered with him. We were sitting at dinner in his house. And he said to me, I sometimes wonder what I would do if I were the Americans. His answer, which I thought in itself was a lesson, seemed to hurt him. I have no idea, really. It's like a volcano that has erupted. How do you stop that? I thought it was a fitting question. Thank you.
Thank you. We have questions.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you for
First, just for our speaker, if you don't, and the audience, just mind introducing yourselves when you.
My name is Oppenheim, Columbia University.
Hi.
You mentioned the Levant in your presentation. Geographic outline, but there's also a collection of identities and groups that existed in the Middle East, continue to exist in ever dwindling numbers. Levantine is what I'm referring to, and usually meant people of the region who had developed a certain outlook that was Western oriented and was usually associated with Christian Arabs and to some extent also Jews from the region. Maronites, Armenians, Syrian Christians, and so on and so forth. Can you address the status of these communities in this changing environment that you've just described in Iraq and especially Lebanon, as you referenced?
Yeah, I think, it's changing dramatically. I think if we took Lebanon, for instance, this kind of, Beirut, the city that might be identified as the most kind of outward-looking, westward-looking, in a way, was a city of Sunni Muslims and Greek Orthodox. The Maronites were more of more mountain people at that point. The transformation obviously happened over the 20th century, and it happened primarily through their engagement with the French occupation or the French presence in Lebanon. So, and I think that's what is often very compelling is, and it reminds me of Iraq in a way, is that I think, what I'm struck by in Iraq is that, there was this notion, I think, of U.S. policymakers that Iraq was a country of Sunni, Shiites, and Kurds. It was that at some level. And it was also a lot of different things and other things. U.S. policy that was imposed in the time after Saddam's fall was kind of based on that notion of a state of Sunni, Shiites, and Kurds. In a lot of ways, it reinforced those divisions and it helped make a reality that mirrored that preconception. I don't think it was inevitable, but I think today the reality of Iraq is that preconception, that faulty preconception we had before going into the war. And I think Lebanon's a great example of that. I think we saw this in the 19th century, basically, in terms of French and how the French and other foreign powers perceived Lebanon's tapestry, Lebanon's mosaic. And it was a traumatic time for Lebanon. In part, it led to the massacres in 1860 between Druze and Maronites. The role of foreign intervention in accentuating these differences, not that these differences weren't there, they very much were there, but I think the role of foreign intervention in accentuating these ethnic and sectarian divisions in the region is vast, and I think it's sometimes underestimated. And I think we're dealing with a moment right now in the Middle East where these divisions are, like I said, becoming the sole axis around which politics revolve. I think back to my family's ancestral village in southern Lebanon. It's a Greek Orthodox, predominantly Greek Orthodox village. In the 1970s, everybody there was basically a communist or what they call a Syrian nationalist. Usually they get drunk at night and fight in the streets over these differences. Today they're all Christians, and they identify themselves first and foremost as Christians. They look to Michel Aoun as the main leader for them. And I'm always struck by that because I think in some ways that endangers their very presence in the country. Like I said, it reinforces their own uniqueness. And I think that uniqueness is something that has become more and more fragile. And I do worry about the diversity in the Levant. I do worry about the diversity in the Near East, however you want to describe it, because we are seeing politics that don't transcend this more primordial notion of self. And I think that's going to be very difficult to sustain the diversity that has made the region so remarkable in the past.
Itself is not considered even legitimate
right.
by many.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, back in December 2000. Back in December of 2003, I had flown home. I think it was for Christmas, and I remember the guy had back the night before, and I was sitting the next day getting ready to watch the Green Bay Packers play a football game. An obsession with the Packers, and I got a call, and they said that Saddam was captured, and I had to go back, and I left that same day. And I remember being upset, one, because I didn't get to watch the game, but two, is that I just didn't think it was that big of a deal in the country at that point. So much had happened in Iraq between the fall of Saddam and his capture, for instance, back in December 2003, that it felt, in a lot of ways, a more important story in the United States than it did in Iraq. And I think I feel that even more now with the trial of Saddam. Were people watching the trial in Baghdad? Of course they were. It was a great source of gossip. There was this kind of almost this, you know, voyeuristic quality to watching Saddam having been turned into such a tangible figure in a way. Such a, you know, he was there before, you know, before everyone on TV. But in terms of its implications, I just don't see that many implications, either in the region or in Iraq. I think Sunni, if we break it down to Sunni and Shiite kind of politics, you know, I think the Sunni anger will be more over the Shiite reaction to his death rather than the death itself. And I think that's what, it's often colored a lot of the reaction since the beginning is, you know, why are they gloating over Saddam's death and why are they like serving an American agenda? It's less about Saddam and it's more about that kind of perception of you know, how they're reacting. So that's my sense. It could be wrong, but that's just, I don't see it as being that big of a deal in the country, to be honest. Yeah, I tell you. What about dividing the country? Is partition, you know, is a partition a way to deal with this? I don't think there's an American solution at this point, and I just don't. I think if anything, the American presence is making things worse. And you know, I don't know the answer. When Wameed said this to me that he didn't know what he would do for the Americans, I felt very sympathetic because I don't know the answer either. And I have to say I'm pretty pessimistic about what's ahead. You know, if I was forced to make a guess. Most of my guess is usually being wrong, but if I was forced to make a guess, it would be, you know, that an American, the quicker there's an American withdrawal, the better chance there is for some kind of compromise in the country, and that compromise has to be Iraqi. I was struck, when I was in Baghdad, talking to people, there's still Sunni politicians who talk about restoring the alliance with Sadr. And now Sadr being the cleric that is probably the kingmaker at this point in the country, the Shiite, young Shiite cleric who has power because he has a lot of guys with guns. You know, they're still talking about restoring this alliance with Sadr that they had maybe back in the spring of 2004, and this is after there's been so much bloodletting. I mean, the carnage that's been committed in the name of the Mahdi army is just breathtaking, but there's still this talk of like, well, Sadr represents more of a nationalist figure than a sectarian figure. He's much better than the Badr Brigades or the, you know, Scary, the Supreme Council. And I was just struck by that. Not that it's possible necessarily, but that there's still, that there might still be that capacity for some kind of compromise down the road. Who knows? Like I said, I'm not real optimistic about it. But, you know, I think any process that the Americans try to initiate at this point becomes tainted. And I think it comes back to this question of legitimacy that we've been dealing with that since 2003. How do you secure legitimacy when the Americans are always seen as the final arbiter? The Americans are seen as calling the shots. And, you know, I think the argument mainly for the U.S. presence at this point is often that they're keeping a lid on the violence. And I don't see that. I really don't. Partition. I was with Rory Stewart, who's written a good book, Prince of the Marshes. It's a very entertaining book. And he made this point that, you know, that when you face a problem of Iraq where you had artificial borders drawn by foreigners, he wondered how you're going to solve that kind of problem by drawing more artificial borders by foreigners as well. And I think there's some point to that. You know, you really, a partition, I think, is one of those things that you can throw out. And it's in some ways an easy answer. It makes sense because we are still so wed to this notion of Iraq being nothing more than the sectarian and ethnic groupings. But I don't know where you draw the borders. I don't think most Iraqis actually, Iraqi Arabs support a partition, and I think you run into the problem of what would it do about the violence, for instance. And you know, when I was down in Basra, I was working on a story in southern Iraq. You know, there was a free-for-all between Shiite militias. I mean, very bloody free-for-all. You'd wake up one morning in Basra and 20 people have been killed within an hour. This has nothing to do with sectarian differences. I mean, this is a fight for money and power and access to the security apparatus down there. And it would happen with a partition or not with a partition. And I think just add one more thing. I think that's what, you know, I think that we might want to keep an eye on as Iraq goes forward is that these intra-sectarian differences are going to be as important as the inter-sectarian differences. And I think we're already starting to see signs of that in the south and the west.
Yes. If you could speak up or take the mic.
I'm George Gruen, National Committee on American Foreign Policy, and also at CIPA at Columbia University. Question on water. You know, I've been looking at it for years. There were efforts to negotiate an agreement dividing up the Euphrates among Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. Has that progressed anywhere? Where does it stand? And then what's happening in the marshes, which I understand are being cleared, dried out in the south?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything happening in Iraq at this point on those water negotiations, but I may be wrong about that. I may not have the most up-to-date information. I just haven't come across anything or heard anything being done at this point. The marshes have revived. You know, the marshes, there's such an environmental catastrophe in parts of southern Iraq. I mean, you go to Basra, which was just such an incredibly rich landscape, the best dates in the world, for instance, and it's just withering, and it's difficult to look at the landscape out there. You know, the marshes, the way that the marshes were dealt with was they just basically opened the dikes. I mean, they just broke the, and reflooded them. And it's worked in some areas. It's not worked in other areas. So I don't think there's been anything very methodical about trying to revive or resuscitate the marshes. So, but you are saying, I mean, they're back there, fishing is going on. Some parts have been resettled. I mean, it's much better than it was under Saddam when he drained them.
Can I ask a follow-up then, in terms of Turkey's role in all of this? You know, there's stories that they're very unhappy if the Kurds get a certain amount of independence, significant autonomy in northern Iraq, and then this have an influence on the Turks in southeast Anatolia.
Yeah. I think the Turks have been. I may be wrong about this, but they seem to have been pretty restrained given the threat they do consider from what's going on in Kurdistan. I mean, Kurdistan is basically an independent state at this point, and I think most Iraqi Arabs have come to that conclusion as well. You don't hear a lot of Kirkuk is still a huge issue, of course, and where that border is drawn, and there is some depopulation going on at the hands of the Kurds along that line, not only with Arabs, but not only with Muslim Arabs, but with the Christian Arabs as well, or the Chaldeans and other communities. That border is being redrawn. Now, where it's eventually drawn, I don't know, but I think just the notion of Kurdish independence isn't all that controversial anymore in Iraq. I don't feel it that way, at least, in conversations. Now, how Turkey is going to perceive this, how they might try to make a fig leaf for it, you think they'd have to do something, because I don't think that is going to be tolerable for the Turks to have an independent Kurdish state on their border. But, again, it comes back to this thing. I mean, there's so much, the Syrians are paranoid about, and you hear talk of, I've heard rumors of like kind of fomenting trouble among the Kurds in Syria all the way to the Mediterranean, basically. I mean, near Aleppo, the community north of Aleppo. So, this isn't something that's been settled by any means. And again, we're dealing with this increasingly fractured region along sectarian and ethnic lines that I think is going to redraw the map in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, when I was down in southern Iraq, it's kind of remarkable how, to be honest, how well the Iranians have played this since 2003. I mean, especially when you contrast it to, American standing in the region. The Iranians, of course, they don't have their card to play in southern Lebanon anymore, given the war there. It's hard to see another war starting in the short term in southern Lebanon. They still very much do have a card to play in southern Iraq. And, what I was struck is, you have a figure like Muqtada Sadr, for instance, and Sadr has almost built his image and his movement on opposition to Iran. I mean, he is very much of a nationalist figure in some ways, very sectarian also, but he's also kind of espouses a certain Iraqi and Arab nationalism, much in the way that Hezbollah might do in southern Lebanon, where it's very much a sectarian movement, but part of that rhetoric is Arab nationalist and Lebanese nationalist. I think Sadr is inspired in some ways by Hezbollah's approach to politics. Anyway, Sadr being this figure, though, still receives money from the Iranians. I don't think there's any question that he's getting money. And I think every party, basically, there's 18 or 19 political parties in Basra at this point. They all have an association at some level with Iran. The Iranians have been restrained in southern Iraq to a certain degree. They obviously have a national interest in what happens in Iraq. But you do get, and I think a lot of the perception down there is that this is a card they could play if there was a lot more U.S. tension between the United States and Iran. You look across the region, and there's just no question that Iranian prestige is so much greater than it was a few years ago. Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, of course. They haven't made a lot of mistakes at this point. now. Now, there's also a lot of confusion, I think, about the policy, and I think you see that playing out in southern Iraq, that there are often three or four different foreign policies being played out. And I think even in terms of Iranian intelligence, they've kind of picked different groups that each branch might support. And so it's not, I mean, I don't think it's all that methodical in some ways. I think it's a little bit haphazard, but the cumulative effect of it is to, I think, is to bolster its standing and prestige. And I wish I had an answer for that. I feel very bleak about the Middle East right now. I really do. I mean, to the point that I almost don't want to keep covering it as a journalist, I have to say. It's, you know, it's just, it's not good what's ahead. And this stuff is going to play itself out. And I don't know how it plays itself out necessarily, but it's an incredibly bleak moment. I mean, we're dealing with, let's face it, I mean, there is, I think, there's such paranoia in the Middle East that what we're seeing with this kind of fracturing along ethnic and sectarian lines is, you know, I mean, it has been, there's a certain part of Israeli foreign policy that has seen this for a long time, that a region that would be organized along these lines to a greater degree than it is already. You know, I think there's a certain constituency, you know, in U.S. foreign policy that wouldn't be averse to that as well. I mean, it's much easier said than done, of course. You know, do we see example? I think, we're also dealing, alongside that, is the utter failure of Arab states to create any notion of citizenship. I mean, you know, it's just not there. And, you know, Syria is a great example of that. You know, Syria has tried to subsume everything into this, the kind of the Ba'athist notion of Arab nationalism, and it's failed. And, I think instability in Syria would, you know, what would follow that would make Iraq look somewhat organized and somewhat, you know, somewhat tidy. I mean, really, I mean, you do feel that in Syria. When I was there last year, I mean, you feel like everybody was just basically sharpening knives, you know, getting ready for this moment of collapse. Alawites I talked to said they were going to be blamed for the crimes of the regime. They were getting ready to go to the villages. People, I mean, friends of mine were applying for visas. Now, it's a little different in Syria, and I think the government feels much stronger these days in Syria than it did back then. That was definitely a moment of insecurity, but I don't see the way forward, we're dealing with governments that don't really have a vision other than survival at this point. You know, are there interesting things happening? There are. I mean, I think this, you know, the alliance between Hezbollah and Aoun in Lebanon is very interesting. But I remember talking to Michel Aoun a couple of weeks ago, and he basically said to me, the future of the Maronites is with the Shiites in Lebanon, which is a spectacular statement, I mean, when you think about it. But he very much sees it in those terms, is that, you know, this is the way that Christians are going to survive in Lebanon. That's his, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but that's his take on it. And his alliance is unprecedented. It's very interesting, and it is remaking it's kind of reformulating the arithmetic of the country at this point. That's just one small example. I don't see politics in any real fashion that are trying to transcend these ethnic and sectarian divides at this point. I don't see any ideologies that have any kind of appeal. I think the U.S. notion of what, of kind of a civil society of individual rights in this thing, to be honest, is tainted because it is an American idea at this point, and it's suffering because of American standing in the region. I mean, you go to Egypt, and you know, the embassy can't even organize a meeting often of Egyptian intellectuals at this point because you don't want to be tainted by that association with the United States. They were organizing a protest, and they were worried that they were being perceived as too Western and too pro-American, so they said, well, we need to introduce more anti-American slogans to buttress our credentials, you know. And I think that's actually that's somewhat indicative of the mood across the region.
I just wanted to follow up on Julia's question about
ethnic and sectarian divide. A lot of the people that you interview in the book and who are featured in some of your recent reporting are middle class people. There seems to be, you talk about this big exodus of people to Jordan. I'm thinking about Wameed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you would fit your notion of somebody who's kind of a middle class kind of person.
Yeah.
But there seems to be millions of people exiting Iraq and moving to Jordan. I think the number is now well over a million.
I've heard 6 million in terms of above the country. So.
And in one of the recent articles, you talk about the law of Kundara. The people are, which is a shoe in Iraqi Arabic, and that people are stuffing shoes down each other's throats, solving everything with, you know, violence and fear. Who is? There are all these important decisions that are going to be taken. If the middle class, 6 million people, I mean that's a quarter of the population, has exited, who is going to be making these important decisions?
It's a great question, and I wonder about that. I mean, this he was referring to as the Kundara, which is the Kundara is a way to say shoe, and there was this moment in Iraqi parliament where there was a debate whether they should set up a committee that would determine whether legislation was permissible under Islam. And somebody, you know, there was a debate whether they should do this or not, and finally the speaker gets up at one point and says, any legislation that goes against Islam, we'll put it under the Kundara. And a friend of mine said, you know, what we're dealing with is a culture of the Kundara at this point. And so I'm going to shove a Kundara down his throat. I'm going to hit him with a Kundara, you know. And he was making a point of just the level that politics have reached at this point. And there's some truth to that. And I have to be honest. I mean, Iraqi politics have often been very violent. I mean, there is a tradition there that, you know, going back to the 50s of politics often playing themselves out through violence, not to this degree, obviously. And I don't think any Iraqis, very few, would have imagined that things would have reached the point they've reached today. I think that you're right, this middle class having left, and the middle class was devastated in the 1990s. Basically, anyone with money at this point has left the country. Wameed, you know, makes $1,000 a month as a professor, but if he left, he wouldn't make that money, and so he really can't leave because then he would be broke in Jordan, so he stays. I asked this question of him. I shouldn't have asked in front of his family, but his entire family started yelling about how they need to leave, and, you know, Wameed was a little bit beleaguered there. You know, I do think that it is a. If there's who's going to decide Iraq's future in a lot of ways, this might be too bold of a statement, but it's Sadr. I mean, Sadr is the kingmaker at this point, and everyone, you know, wants to have Sadr. Maliki wants to have him. So the Sunnis still want to have him in a certain degree. The Supreme Council, scary, is afraid of him, terrified of him, this is a guy who, I tell you, I met him a few weeks after the invasion. I remember going to Najaf and I didn't know anything about the situation. I said, who's in charge here? And they said, well, it's Sistani or Sadr. So I couldn't see Sistani, so I went and saw Sadr. And here was this young guy who, you know, the rumor was he was playing video games before the invasion. And he was, you know, here. He was quiet. He was shy. He was insecure. He wasn't sure of himself. And this ascent of him over 3 years is spectacular. Again, it's one of these unintended consequences. But he is the kingmaker. And I think, you know, he's the kingmaker because he has the street. And he has, you know, his men could take over any city in southern Iraq in a matter of 48 or 72 hours, including Basra. The Americans underestimated him time and again in 2003 and 2004, and I think in some ways we're dealing with the legacy of that today.
Did you have your hand?
Well, thank you. Yes. Referring to the anti-Americanism, it's the same atmosphere vis-a-vis American nonprofits and other institutions?
It's a good question. And I tell you, this is something that I've always been struck by as a reporter in the Middle East, is that, you know, and I think to much a greater degree than you would see in the United States, people often make that distinction between U.S. policy and American citizens. And I never felt uncomfortable in the region, I mean, until recently. I mean, it really was a great distinction that was made, and I was always struck by that. I was very impressed by it. I think that distinction is fading at this point, and I think it's fading in pretty, pretty dramatic ways, definitely in Iraq. I mean, you know, but even another, you know, I think Tripoli, for instance, in northern Lebanon, I think it would be dangerous to go there in 2 or 3 years with an American passport. You know, how does that do it with, you know, nonprofits? You know, there's often, I think, in terms of NGOs, nonprofits, groups trying to do work, there's still a lot of work being done in the region. They are, they do have to be careful about that association in an official capacity with the U.S. government, and that does trouble them. And the governments often exploit it. They exploit these sentiments in a way and make it more difficult. Egypt's a great example of like the trouble that I think either India or IRA ran into recently with that. But yeah, I think this is, it's starting to, it's, you know, I think these red lines are starting to be blurred in a, you know, pretty dramatic fashion. I think even with journalists, you know, just I think like on a personal aside, you know, I always felt that we were treated as non-combatants in a way, you know, all through the 90s and, even into the period that followed September 11th. You know, it's not the case as much anymore. I mean, journalists, I don't think, are treated as non-combatants. And I felt that especially in Iraq. And we brought it on ourselves in Iraq in a lot of ways. I mean, we started carrying guns. We started riding around in armored cars with armed escorts. And so we brought it upon ourselves as well. But I think it was happening at a parallel track, you know, by perception at the same time.
Just speak up.
I'm Rachel Guillermo, and I'm with the public health program here at OSI. Some journalists, like Seymour Hersh, have suggested that an attack, American attack on Iran, is a realistic possibility. Do you agree? Has your research and reporting turned up any signs of that?
You know, I don't work in Washington that much, so it's hard for me to say. I mean, just my sense is that, I could see Israel doing it before I'd see the Americans doing it. It would be breathtaking, to be honest. I mean, I think I'd leave. but you know, there is that very deep fear of a nuclear-armed Iran. So, you know, who knows? Especially with this administration basically being lame duck in a way at this point. I mean, that they have no election to stand for. Does this bolster their perception of having latitude? I mean, doing things they might not do otherwise. I don't know, but. It's hard for me. I know what he's writing on this stuff. It is hard for me to imagine. It is, I gotta say. But it was hard for me to imagine us invading Iraq too. So I don't know.
You talk about the unintended consequences. Maybe you were talking about some of the other reporting you've been doing over the summer. I noticed in the book that you're from Marjoun. Your family originally came from southern Lebanon. You were reporting there, and recently you've written some reflections about what you think were the consequences of the summer war between Israel and Hezbollah, I guess you would say. No, not so much between Israel and Lebanon, but what do you see as being the consequences?
You know, I think that's, I think at the, and this struck me again and again when I was down in southern Lebanon during the war, was that, you know, you're basically hitting a China plate with a sledgehammer, and it just is not going to come back together all that well. And I think what it did in some ways, in the same way that the invasion did to Iraq, is that there are forces that have been incubating there for a long time, and this kind of brings them out into the open. I mean, I think one way to read Lebanon, one way to perceive Lebanon since the early 70s, the role of Musa Sadr, for instance, in the movement of the dispossessed, you know, is basically the ascent of the Shiite community in Lebanon. You know, it's the reformulation of this agreement that happened in the 1940s between the Sunnis and the Maronites. That agreement's obviously outdated at this point. I think what we've been seeing since the early 70s, and I think this war might be read as the climax in a way of that arc, is of Shiite empowerment in Lebanon. Now, most other communities in Lebanon aren't prepared for that, and that's why I think Aoun is kind of remarkable, because I think he sees it is in some ways going to become a Shiite country, and I think Aoun realizes that very, very blunt terms. Now, the problem is less, you know, this empowerment, and it's more the resistance to that empowerment. And I think that's what we're seeing play out right now in Lebanon, is that there is pressure by Hezbollah and Aoun to bring down the government, to reformulate the government, to bring in more Hezbollah and Aoun ministers that could basically have a veto power over decisions. And there's an incredible amount of resistance to it. And they have the Americans on their side, the people who are resisting it. You know, redoing the government would be much less difficult than the process, than the rejection of it in some ways. And I think that's going to bring out, you know, people are throwing out very, very casually this idea of bringing people into the streets. You know, Hezbollah's threatened it. March 14th, people, basically the groups that are opposed to it, threaten it as well. And, you know, once it goes to the streets, you know, all bets are off in a way. I mean, I hate to use cliches, but I mean, it's, you know, that's not good. And I think this is going to have to somehow be resolved. I don't know, I don't see how you reconcile it. I do think, you know, again, the Awan Hezbollah alliance is, I think, is very key to watch. It's very interesting, but it doesn't seem, it's hard for me to see how it end, you know, how it resolves itself very, very easily anytime soon. Yeah, you know, it's so interesting, this debate that's going on about that. It's like the idea was right, it was just executed wrong. And I think it kind of fits into this notion of blaming Iraqis for, you know, they just weren't ready for what we were going to bring them, which I think isn't fair at all. And, you know, what was inevitable and what was inevitable is something I struggled with in writing Night Drosnir. What was inevitable? And, you know, I don't think the project in and of itself was workable. I really don't, from the beginning. And I say that, and that's more of a gut feeling than that I could argue out in a kind of a reasoned fashion. But, you know, my gut sense is that it just was, it was delusional in some ways. And, you know, was it inevitable that you were going to have an insurgency when you had U.S. troops on the ground in Iraq? Definitely. I mean, without question. Was, you know, was part of the sectarian and ethnic tension that we see playing out right now inevitable? You know, given the U.S. association with the exile parties, the U.S., you know, preconception of what Iraq really was, yeah, it was. Now, did it have to reach the point it reached today? No, it didn't. It didn't. And I think these are, you can definitely look to certain policies that brought us to this point, yeah, in some ways. But, you know, could this have ever succeeded? Not that I see.
Okay, I think we'll take maybe one last question and then.
Question about Syria and Israel. There was, shortly before Assad Senior died, there was a lot of talk about an agreement. Israel would give up the Golan Heights and Syria would make peace with Israel. And then he died and his son came in. The place where it broke down, I understand, was that the Israelis, and I think Olmert and others have said, they're willing to withdraw from the Golan Heights, but their definition of where the border is the 1922 border, yeah, which gives all of the Sea of Galilee to Palestine, which is now Israel. The Syrians said no, they had a little piece of their army. The armistice agreement was in 49, but they controlled them there for they want. So basically the question of, does Syria get a role in the war or riparian rights?
Yeah.
Do you see any chance of a Syrian-Israeli deal, but you know, Olmert is looking for something to show that they've done something successfully, and I assume Bashar Assad is also eager to show some success.
I, you know, I don't write it at this point because it depends on the Americans. It depends on the United States. Are they going to put the pressure that they would have to put to make a deal possible? And I just don't see that. I mean, the U.S. there's basically no dialogue going on with Syria at this point. I mean, the Syrians are desperate for something. You know, it's a Ba'athist government, and a Ba'athist, you know, the one thing about the Ba'athists is they're very, you know, they've always been very opportunistic about, you know, they'll do a lot to ensure the survival of the regime. And so, I mean, I think the Syrians would fall over themselves to try to do something that would appease the Americans, but, you know, but the American definition of what it would take is somewhat unclear, and it's also somewhat elusive. It is, and I think that's, you know, I'm not privy to anything, you know, behind the scenes on the assassination itself, but I sure feel like the pressure's kind of come off on that, you know, and it's still a big deal in Lebanon, no question about it, forming this tribunal, but I think it's going to end inconclusively, the investigation. It's nothing like what Melis was doing, you know, when I think the Syrian government was actually terrified about what was ahead. I remember sitting with a minister in Damascus, and, you know, she had this idea that because I worked for the Washington Post, I had some association with the government, and she turned to me at one point and says, you know, what do we do? And I was like, I have no idea what you do. But there was just such a fear, and this was a person that was somewhat, you know, plugged in. You know, so it's, you know, would the Syrians strike a deal with the Americans? I think they would strike a deal with the Americans in a minute. But I think the deal that the Americans would insist on is probably would threaten the survival of the regime at this point, which would probably, you know, cut off its, you know, some, you know, cut off its relationship with Iran. I mean, there's a long list that would, in some ways, threaten the regime's survival. So, I don't see much happening along that track. I do think Syria is in a much better position, or feels itself to be in a much better position than it was a year ago, in pretty dramatic fashion.
Okay, I'd like to remind everybody that Night Draws Near is out in paperback, and agents of Picador are here selling it. And if I've read it, I recommend it. And otherwise, you can meet Anthony Shadid on a couple days a week in the pages of the Washington Post and a good archive online of his articles. I want to thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And
I appreciate everyone coming. I enjoyed it.